Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and it's Monday, September 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast first thing. It comes from KCRG-TV. Low pressure hangs around, bringing scattered storm chances. A storm system will slowly move through the region over the next couple of days, carrying some scattered showers and storms with it. An associated frontal boundary stretches from the low center in Minnesota across the eastern half of the area this morning. Right along this boundary, we've seen patchy areas of fog develop, and that remains a possibility until mid-morning. Like some recent mornings, be prepared for changing visibility conditions on your morning commute to work or school. Otherwise, a decent amount of sunshine will be present early in the day, with some scattered clouds becoming more likely as the day goes on. By the afternoon, scattered showers and storms will be possible in parts of the area, with our northern counties and those along the frontal boundary somewhat more favored for this activity. While the storms will be scattered, they will be slow moving. Isolated areas of heavy rainfall are possible as a result, though many areas will miss out on any rain entirely today. Highs reach the mid-70s to low 80s. A few showers and storms are possible tonight as well, as lows hit the upper 50s to low 60s. An increase in activity is possible into the afternoon as we warm up a little bit, with the area of low pressure tracking right through eastern Iowa. Due to a slightly cooler air mass getting into the area and increased cloud and rain activity, highs will likely be held back in the upper 60s to low 70s. Drier weather returns for the middle of the week and will stick around for at least several days to follow. A large area of high pressure sets up the eastern United States, generally bringing quiet weather to the area. We will be on the warm side of the high, though, with temperatures gradually climbing pretty decently above normal into the low 80s by the weekend. Now let's turn to the sports section. In high school football, number one Spartans survive. Grundy Center uses two defensive scores to top Columbus. Dateline Waterloo. Top-ranked Grundy Center scored a pair of defensive touchdowns and held off a fierce fourth-quarter comeback to beat Columbus Catholic 21-14 Thursday in a Class 1A game at T.J. McLaughlin Field. The Spartans, 5-0, caught a deflective pass in the end zone to lead 7-0 at halftime, and then star quarterback Colin Gordon stripped and then returned a fumble 92 yards for a touchdown in the fourth quarter to give Grundy Center a 14-0 lead. But the Sailors, 3-2, refused to sink. Columbus Catholic sandwiched a Miles Gardner wide receiver sweep for a touchdown and Carter Lockhart 9-yard strike to Nick Haggerty around a Gordon 1-yard score for Grundy Center in an electric fourth quarter. The game wasn't sealed until Riker Thorin recovered an onside kick with 2 minutes 38 seconds left in the fourth quarter, and the Spartans were able to run out the clock. Quote, "We found a way to scrap and get out of here with a win," Grundy Center head coach Travis Zajac said. "I'm very proud of our kids and coaching staff," unquote. Missed opportunities will be what the Sailors remembered as they went toe-to-toe with a team that has played in 4 consecutive state championship games. Quote, "What a high school football game," Columbus Catholic head coach Brad Smith said. "I told the guys, yeah, it was a loss, but we talk about you don't lose, you learn, and what we learned tonight is we are darn good. Our kids got a heck of a lot better tonight," unquote. Defensive score number one. Grundy Center had allowed just 19 points in its first 4 games, so Columbus Catholic knew it needed to not give the Spartans anything free. Unfortunately, that wasn't accomplished by the sailors. It appeared Columbus had grabbed some momentum when Parker Jedson tracked down a deep pass by Gordon and picked it off at the Sailor 5 to stop a Spartan drive. But on a 3rd and 12 from the 3, Lockhart was about to be sacked in the end zone for a safety. As he was being pulled to the ground, he inadvisedly threw a pass forward. It hit one of his linemen in the backside and ricocheted backwards into the hands of Grundy centers Tiernan Volks for a touchdown and a 7-0 Spartan lead with 4:29 left to halftime. Quote, "Carter knows better than that, and he's kicking himself for that, which is fine," Smith said. "You look at the two mistakes we made tonight, yeah, a lot of what-ifs. But at the same time, we have to move forward, and I certainly like where we are at," unquote. Defensive score number 2. Accurately, Columbus Catholic dominated the third quarter, and that could be said for much of the fourth. The Sailors marched from their own 25, converting 3 third-down plays and taking nearly 8 minutes off the third-quarter clock to start the second half before missing a 31-yard field goal. Then, when a pass interference called granted them a first and goal from the Grundy Center 3, Gordon came up big for the Spartans. Columbus running back Parker Jedson bounced a ball to the outside where he was met by Gordon, who in the process of tackling Jedson was able to strip the ball free. Gordon then scooped up the ball and raced the length of the field for a 14-0 lead. There was no give up in the Sailors. It took Columbus 5 plays to respond. A 55-yard pass from Lockhart to Thomas Steele set up Gardner's touchdown sweep, and it was a 14-7 ball game with 7:20 left. Quote, "Credit our guys down 14 and that play. What a swing of events that was," Smith said. "Obviously a ton of credit to them, because the difference between a good team and a team that has been in the championship game 4 years in a row, they make those plays. But at the same time, our kids deserve an unbelievable amount of credit as well, because we fought to the bitter end. Because after that string of events, it would have been easy to fold up," unquote. Grundy Sender also had a quick response as a 26-yard Gordon run sparked a quick Spartan scoring drive as Gordon snuck the ball over from the 1 for a 21-7 lead with 3:58. It wasn't clean, but Grundy Sender stays perfect. The Spartans were outgained by the Sailors and outplayed for long stretches of the second half, but when the final buzzer sounded, the Spartans had the win. Quote, "We knew they were a good football team," Zajac said. "That game against West Branch, we could have gone either way. They are physical. They have playmakers. They are well coached," unquote. "Unfortunately, we did not play a very clean game," he added. "We had a lot of penalties, but our defense played very well when it needed, and our offense put together a big drive when we needed it," unquote. In junior college volleyball, Hawkeye sweeps NIAC. Dateline Waterloo. Hawkeye Community College defeated the North Iowa Area Community College, NIAC, in Iowa Community College Athletic Conference volleyball action on Thursday. Ranked number 15 in the NJCAA Division II Top 25, the Red Tails took down the Trojans in a sweep 25-20, 25-13, 25-20, handing NIAC its 7th consecutive loss. Hawkeye head coach Diane Wolfensberger took both positives and negatives from the win, though she noted the Red Tails offense stole the show. Quote, "They came out a little slowly, but they picked it up," Wolfensberger said. "Offensively, we did some really great things. We ran a rotational defense, which works really well against NIAC, so they did a really good job with that. Service receive could have improved a little bit, but there were some highlights in there. But offensively, I think we did really well," unquote. As Offensberger noted, Hawkeye opened the night slowly, falling behind 5-1 in the first set, as the Trojans reeled off a 4-point run to to get out to a sizable advantage. Wolfensberger highlighted unforced errors, specifically serve-receive, as the cause for the Red Tails' struggles in falling behind early in sets 1 and 3, but felt her team showed resiliency in finding wins. According to Wolfensberger, a number of key attributes allowed the Red Tails to get off to their strong 13-4 start to the season. She also noted that a trip to the Region 11A championship last season is helping to motivate her team this season. "I think our girls can definitely see some postseason play in their future, as long as they keep doing the things they need to do. I think they're pretty bought in," unquote. Now we have UNI football. Sander draws fearsome comparison. Redshirt freshman looks to be better than brother Corby. Dateline Cedar Falls. The call came in late. The Northern Iowa secondary was still looking to the sidelines for its signals 2 seconds before Idaho State quarterback Jordan Cook snapped the ball. Cook took the snap and winged a quick screen out of the left for wide receiver Sheldon James. With blockers in front, James looked to break off an explosive play on the first and 10 inside UNI territory. "I think I kind of buried the lead here. The score was 41-17 and a victory for the Panthers. We have a photograph at the top of the story, and the caption says, Northern Iowa redshirt freshman Tate Sander tackles Idaho State's Michael Shulikov in the Panthers' 41-17 victory on Saturday in Pocatello, Idaho. UNI defensive backs coach Kalen Brookins, who pushes his players to be aggressive, be violent, and be feared, mythologized Sanders with a fearsome comparison. Quote, "He is a guy that listens and learns," Brookins said. "He waits. He waits for the perfect moment. And he asks the right questions. Then, when it is time to strike, he strikes. He is like that cobra that hides out, but you know it is there. Once you know it is there, you're like, I am going nowhere near that again. That is where Tate is. He works his butt off." According to Brookins, Sander practices how he plays, fast. Sander finished the game against Idaho State with 6 tackles, tied for second most on UNI, and 1 forced fumble, though he also intercepted a pass in the third quarter, which was negated by an offside penalty against UNI. UNI head coach Mark Farley said Sander's consistency in practice and ability to flash in limited in opportunities earned him the opportunity to start against Idaho State on Saturday. In a win underscored by intensity on defense, Farley added that Sander's play helped raise the performance of the entire defense, that they had to go out there and earn their jobs every day because Tate Sanders is coming, Farley said. "You have to play like that on game day, and not just during the week. We played with a lot more intensity. I was pleased with how they hit," unquote. Sander's desire and effort to exceed his brother is evident to Brookins, who played with and coached Corby at UNI. "I told him, do not be your brother," Brookins said. "Tate is a little more serious. You could tell he wants to be his brother, but he also wants to be better than his brother. There was always that big brother, little brother, I set the standard here. Now it's your job to move it." Quote, "Corby did a great job to instill that in Tate, and Tate has done a wonderful job like, quote, hey, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it a little better than you did it," unquote. Now here's a story about the National Cattle Congress Fair. A day at NCC Fair becomes classroom for students gaining new experiences. Story filed by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. Hundreds of school children paraded around the National Cattle Congress grounds this week to get a closer look at agriculture. Students from the Cedar Falls and Waterloo Community School Districts visited the fair with their class during this year's National Cattle Congress Fair, which continues until Sunday evening. Megan Bruns, a second-grade teacher at Cedar Heights Elementary School in Cedar Falls, said her students found out they were coming to the fair on Thursday, and they couldn't contain their excitement the whole week. Going to the fair wasn't just a fun trip for Bronze's students. She's taught them then about things like crops and farm animals. Quote, "It's important in Iowa and a great opportunity to experience it," Bronze said. "Not everyone gets that experience." All the students attending got to walk through the Hall of Breeds and barns with the show animals, as well as the one-room schoolhouse on the site, where they learned what it was like to attend classes decades ago. Children got some hands-on experience, too, when visiting Sunrise Children's Zoo. Patty Nye, the head curator for the zoo, said children can feed goats, horses, mules, burros, a deer, and even a llama. They were also allowed to go to the chicken and duck pen. Quote, "I love to see the excitement and joy in their faces," Nye said. One of those excited children was Cora Moore, a second grader at Cedar Heights. Quote, "Now I feel bad because I eat chicken," she said, leaving the chicken pen. Moore said in her classroom, she has learned about agriculture and how important it is to the state. While at the petting zoo, she said she learned how farm animals really act. Quote, "Goats like to poop a lot," she said, "and chickens like to eat," unquote. She said that her favorite farm animal is a cow, which wasn't one of the animals at the petting zoo, but there were an abundance of them in the show barns. Some of those cows were owned by Don and Glenda Eilers and their children from Scotch Grove. Don Eilers said he retired from milking cows 10 years ago this week and is showing the only animals he has left, 8 heifers and 1 cow. A heifer is a female that hasn't given birth. All the cattle he was showing were under 2 years old, with the youngest born this month. The Eilers started showing cattle in 1974 and have come to the National Cattle Congress Fair for about 50 years. Their 3 children and 7 grandchildren are also continuing the tradition. One of their granddaughters was in the barn moving hay. "The fair is laid back, quiet, and a nice show to come through," Don Eller said. "It's a lot of fun showing, and I enjoy seeing the kids coming through," unquote. Next door in the Hall of Breeds, a barn filled with animals sourced by Hawkeye Community College, students and instructors were present to teach fairgoers about their program. Students from the college's Animal Science, Agriculture Business, and Vet Assistant program had a kiddie pool full of baby chicks, born on Tuesday, for people to pet. The barn also included adult chickens, sheep, and cattle. Sasquatch, the state's biggest boar, also made it an appearance. Sasquatch, whose owner lives in Winthrop, won the 2023 Iowa State Fair title in the Big Boar Competition. He weighs 1,012 pounds, more than 100 pounds heavier than the second-place winner. Amber Greenman, an agronomy and agriculture business instructor at the college, said the reason for the Hall of Breeds is to expose people to the common breeds of animals in Iowa, as well as a few uncommon breeds like the long-haired Highland cattle. Mid-Autumn Moon Festival set at Hearst Center for the Arts. Story filed by Melody Parker. Dateline Cedar Falls. A celebration of the moon will usher in fall at the Hearst Center for the Arts. The Mid-Autumn Moon Festival is from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the center, 304 West Searley Boulevard, in collaboration with the University of Northern Iowa's International Engagement Office. Participants will paint lanterns, make and enjoy mooncakes, and other activities, said Sherry Huber-Ording, Hearst Program Coordinator. The event is free and open to the public. Quote, "We'll hang up the lanterns on the patio, and people can take pictures and then take home their lanterns. UNI international students will bring food to share, and mooncakes are a traditional part of moon festivals," she explained. Many Asian cultures celebrate moon festivals during the harvest season, and mooncakes, considered a delicacy, are made, shared, and eaten. Lanterns symbolize lighting a path to prosperity and good fortune. Asian students represent a large portion of UNI's international student program, said Ava Dietrich, IEO programming coordinator. This will be the university's third Moon Festival and the first to take place at the Hearst Center. Quote, "The Hearst has been amazing when it comes to collaboration, offering us a space in the community, and we can utilize with our international students," she explained. In 2022, Holi Festival, a significant Hindu celebration, was the first event in the partnership. Corey Hurlis, City of Cedar Falls Cultural Programs Supervisor and Hearst Center Director, said the collaboration has been a natural fit to deliver to the community, providing programming and activities for the community to promote cultural awareness, unquote. This partnership encourages interaction between students and community members. Quote, "That's especially important for our students. The Cedar Valley is a surprisingly diverse community, and we want to take advantage of that and show the community what an amazing, vibrant, and enthusiastic international community we have at UNI. And our students want to have that Midwestern experience. We want them to get out and experience things that can be part of making Iowa their home. This partnership with the Hearst is one of the ways we can make those connections," unquote. International Education Week is November 13th through the 17th. IEO will host a Taste of Culture food fair from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on November 14th in the Mocker Union. Activities and performances will take place, and UNI Catering will provide a range of cultural dishes. Quote, "We have close to 54 countries represented on campus, which, for a college in the Midwest, is a lot," said Dietrich. Hearst instructors will host an art workshop from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on November 15th to teach students how to make Korean lotus lanterns. Another instructor will play the cello. Now here we have a summary of the election ballots that are set for Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Waverly. The story was filed by Andy Malone, and we start out in Waterloo. A few days ago, no one had filed for the Ward 4 seat on the Waterloo City Council. When the filing period ended Thursday, three people were on the ballot. A three-person council race also has emerged in Cedar Falls for the at-large seat, one of three contested races involving no incumbents in the city. Waverly has seen two people file for the mayor's chair, including one former longtime council member, to headline two contested races and a seat with no candidates. City and school board elections will take place on November 7th. In Waterloo, the Ward 4 seat was filled during a special election last year after former council member Jerome Amos Jr. was voted into the legislature. Belinda Creighton Smith overwhelmingly won the election, and she is running again for a full four-year term. Creighton Smith, who did not provide her age, lives at 416 Oliver Street. She is the pastor of Faith Temple Baptist Church and an instructor at the University of Northern Iowa in the area of social work, focusing on cultural competency. The others fighting for her seat are Sarah Shervany and Josh Gramlich. Shervany, 41, is a credit manager at Birch Cabinet and lives at 127 Alta Vista Drive. Gramlich, 41, works as an assembler at John Deere and lives at 1838 Patton Avenue. Incumbent Mayor Quentin Hart now has an opponent. Hart, 52, is running for his fifth term as mayor. He was first elected in 2015 after serving for 8 years as the Ward 4 representative. He lives at 1940 Falcon Ridge Drive. Running against him is Wayne Nathan. Nathan previously owned multiple businesses in the area. He's run for multiple government positions before, including the mayor's seat. He did not provide his age, but lives at 548 Cloverdale Avenue. Four names are now on the ballot for one of the city's at-large council seats. It is currently held by Dave Bozen, who is running for Ward 2 instead. Current Ward 2 council member Jonathan Greider is hoping to stay on the council, but switch to the at-large position. Greider, 33, teaches social studies at West High School. He lives at 2719 Edgemont Avenue. Grider's first opponent, Steve Simon, announced his campaign in July. The 57-year-old businessman and founder of Eclipse Dental lives at 1140 Kaplan Drive. The two latest filers are Corey Holmes and Ashley Chappelle. Chappelle, 28, is a content creator on multiple social media apps, and her goal, if elected, is to bring the community back together. She lives at 122 West Hills Lane. Holmes lives at 3711 Ravenwood Circle and is the pastor of Mount Moriah Missionary Baptist Church. Bozen is running uncontested for the Ward 2 seat. If reelected, this would be his second term on the council. Bozen, 66, worked with Waterloo Fire Rescue for 28 years and an additional 6 years with the Waterloo Police Department. He lives at 3203 Marigold Drive, now Cedar Falls. Hannah Chrisman, 33, of 820 West 12th Street, will be on the ballot for the at-large council seat, as previously announced. She's a quality assurance analyst and the College Hill Partnership board president. She'll compete for the seat against two late filers, Patrick McElhaney, 38, of 4101 Horseshoe Drive, and Donna Bash, 52, of 1802 Quail Run Lane. McElhaney is a senior media specialist at the University of Northern Iowa. Bash could not be immediately reached by press time. Glenn Keith, a former Blackhawk County Veterans Affairs Commission member and now legal and office assistant, had announced intentions but did not follow through on them. Incumbent Dave Sires is stepping down from the seat and not running for a second term, citing challenges with making progress on his initiatives. Two candidates are running for the city's mayoral office: Walter Bertus, 33, of 1916 Ashland Avenue, is the owner of the Brass Tap, and Danny Ludick, 34, of 4516 Coronado Court, is the executive director of startup catalyst Red Cedar and formerly an economic and community development professional with Grow Cedar Valley. Mayor Rob Green is not running for a third term out of a desire to spend more time with his family. Previously, he had worked in information technology in the University of Northern Iowa. The Ward 4 seat will represent the third contested race in Cedar Falls, as two have officially filed. Gabe Gruthius, 25, of 2715 Garden Avenue, is a financial advisor. Aaron Hobacker, 55, of 2309 Iowa Street, is the state's chief public defender in Waterloo. Ward 4 Councilmember Simon Harding is not seeking a second term, citing home life and his musical instrument business as needing to occupy more of his time. Ward 2's Susan DeBurr has decided to step away after more than 20 years serving. She wants to spend more time with family, including her husband, who's battling cancer. She's a business owner and previously had careers in public safety and insurance. Chris Latta, 38, of 5301 Fernwood Drive, is the only candidate for that seat. He's Mercy One Northeast Iowa's Director of Behavioral Health. Now we go to Waverly. Longtime City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Timothy Kangas, 51, is seeking to become mayor. The Mason City Community School District Talent Development Coordinator is in the middle of his fourth term. Mark Anderson, 60, has also filed. He's a recently retired Lutheran pastor. Waverly Mayor Adam Hoffman is not seeking a third term in office. The newly appointed Bremer County Treasurer has decided he needs to dedicate more time to that new role, as well as to his family. Jennifer Wolf, 51, who spent time as an occupational therapist and an advocate for those with disabilities, is seeking the Ward 2 seat. Wolf recently lost in a bid for Iowa Senate. James Redemacher is the second candidate. He's senior designer at Lifeline Emergency Vehicles, according to his LinkedIn page. The seat is currently held by Julie Myers, 64, owner of Design 360, who was elected during a 2021 special election and is finishing up the term of a former Ward 2 council member who left the area. She is moving across town and will be seeking election to the at-large seat. The current holder of the seat, Matthew Snyder, is not seeking a second term out of a desire to devote more time to his business ventures. Ward 4 council member Heather Bufor is not seeking a second term out of a desire to spend more time with her family. Her professional role in the pre-nursing program at the Waterloo Career Center is also becoming busier. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 25th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. For our first editorial today, we have a short one from the Storm Lake Times Pilot. It's from the editor, Art Cullen. The title is Vexatious Board. The Iowa Public Information Board is a good idea gone bad. It was created by law to hear complaints about open records and open meetings violations, but has never lived up to its task. The board recently suggested that the legislature should bar vexatious records requesters from asking for public records anymore, even if they pay taxes and are citizens. If they are a pain for the city clerk, they could be declared vexatious by the Public Information Board. This is how they treat people in autocracies. Once you are labeled vexatious, you are a second-class citizen with no right to see your birth certificate at the recorder's office that would prove you are a first-class citizen. Once you are vexatious, we suppose you could become a threat to order and subject to some sort of contempt citation if you continue to insist on seeing how much a county official spent on hotel bills in Des Moines. That's how they roll in China and Singapore. It's not the American way. We're not sure what the threshold is. Do you get 3 requests for old council minutes? 10? Does it matter if you smile when you ask? Any decent reporter could be considered vexatious. We recall an old man in Algona who was vexatious and extremely smart, who learned a lot of things about county and city officials and how they spent money. He was vexatious. He was a taxpayer's watchdog. Wasteful spending drove the curmudgeon to drive us to wit's end because he never stopped until he died. The public considered him a pain, but he was tolerated because he was so often right. We have suggested before that since the board does so little, it should be disbanded. Clearly, it has too much time on its hands if it's drumming up such silliness. The longer this board goes on, the less transparent government becomes. Next, from the New York Times, we have Being There, an opinion by David French. I want to begin this column by sharing with you one of the worst things I ever did. I was only 18 years old, but that was no excuse. Late one night, I got a call from a close friend. Quote, "My dad's on the way to the hospital," he said. "It's really bad." His voice was shaking. I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. More important, I didn't know what to do. I told my friend that I was so sorry. I told him I'd pray for him. And then I went to sleep. I called my friend the next morning. No answer. I asked around. He was at the hospital. The same pattern repeated for 2 long days. I'd call, no answer. I'd ask about him and find out he was at the hospital. But I didn't go. To this day, I can't replicate the thought processes that kept me away. I remember feeling some irrational confidence that his father would be fine. I remember being busy. I remember feeling not quite prepared to face such a pain and loss. Then I got the call. My friend's father had died. I did go to the visitation. I knew, at the very least, that's what friends do. What happened next is burned into my heart. When I walked in the door, my friend came up to me, looked at me with immense hurt, and said, quote, "Where were you?" unquote. I had no answer then. I have no answer now. I failed, and the older I get, the better I understand the magnitude of my failure. I had violated the first commandment of friendship, presence. Simply being there was all that had been required. I couldn't pass even that one simple test. Last week, I read a poignant piece arguing that the male loneliness epidemic was afflicting a surprising group, American fathers. In one sense, these were men who were surrounded by love. They were typically married. They had children. Yet they still felt alone. They struggled to make friends. The longer we march through these anxious, sad, and divided times, the more I'm convinced that the bigger story, the story behind the story of our bitter divisions and furious conflicts, is our loss of belonging, our escalating loneliness. And one of the markers is the extraordinary decline of friendship. According to an American Prospective survey, between 1990 and 2021, the percentage of Americans reported that they had no close friends at all quadrupled. For men, the number had risen to 15%. Almost half of all Americans surveyed reported having three close friends or fewer. The statistics raise the question, why? I'd suggest that a big part of the answer lies in the story I told above. Ever since I started thinking and writing about America's loss of belonging, I've been asking people what the virtue they value most in a friend. I've asked people who are religious and secular, white collar and blue collar, men and women, black and white. And it's remarkable how often the answer boils down to the single virtue I mentioned above, of presence, of being there. Time and again, I hear versions of this answer, one that grows more salient the longer you live and the greater the headwinds you face. Quote, "A friend is there when you need him. A friend picks up the phone when you call at 2 a.m. A friend stands with you." The temptation of absence destroys the virtue of presence, and that absence, as I showed as a younger man, need not come through shocking neglect or selfishness. It can occur simply because you're busy. I've seen it with my own eyes. Most Americans make their close friends through work. So what happens when friends change jobs and they're suddenly just gone? There are times, too, when friends can almost seem to disappear owing to parenthood, especially if their kids play sports or are engaged in extracurricular activities. Quote, "This summer is rough for me. Travel soccer is destroying our calendar." And yes, you often make friends with other parents while you watch your kids play. But next year, your child might be on a new team, with new parents around, and all the parent friends you just made are suddenly gone. I've never met a person who wants to lose friends, but I've met many, many people who suffer from loneliness and say that they just lost touch. What happened? I ask. Life happened, they say. At each new stage of life, it was easier to say no to a friend than to say no to work, to a spouse, to one's kids. And while each individual no can be understandable and even justifiable, the accumulation of no's suffocates friendships, even without an argument, a breach, or a betrayal. During the early pandemic, when Zoom calls were a brand new thing to many of us, I received an unusual invitation from a reader who wrote that he and his old college friends all read me and would I mind joining one of their weekly Zooms? It sounded fun, so I said yes. When I joined, I was struck by the obvious joy of their friendship, the inside jokes, the easy camaraderie. They were much younger than I, in their mid-30s, and before we signed off, they asked if I had any last thoughts. "Stay together," I said. "It's going to get hard. Your kids are young. Your careers are just starting to take off. But stay together. Be there even when it's hard, even when it's inconvenient." After I got off the call, I kicked myself for not remembering a quote by C.S. Lewis, quote, "Friendship is unnecessary," he wrote, "like philosophy, like art, like the universal itself, for God did not need to create. It has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things which give value to survival." That single quote says so much. Compared with the competing demands of family and work, in any given moment, friendship can feel unnecessary. But as the years roll on, and countless justifiable individual absences wear down our relationships, there will come a time when we will feel their loss. But it need not be that way, especially when our simplest and highest command is merely being there. Now from the editorial board at the Des Moines Register, Grassley is right. Government shutdowns achieve nothing. One of the few things Congress actually has to do is appropriate money for government operations. Senators and representatives of both parties have been awful at this task for decades. Under the current appropriation system, Congress has not passed all the necessary annual appropriations bills ahead of the October 1st beginning of the fiscal year since 1997. Sometimes the consequences are more severe than having to pass stopgap measures until negotiations are complete. We might be headed toward another of those times. The Associated Press reported Wednesday that conservatives want to exact significant spending reductions even in a stopgap bill. To condense the politics as much as possible, even if Speaker Kevin McCarthy can muscle such a measure through the Republican-controlled House, and it's a big if, it will never pass the Democratic-controlled Senate. If nothing happens by September 30th, the 11th government shutdown, to include furloughs of federal employees, will likely follow. Shutdowns can cause real harm without achieving their goals. Iowa's four members of the House, all Republicans, are all relatively new to the chamber, and together they make up less than 1% of the body. But with the Republicans' majority being just 10 seats, 222 to 212, dissent from any voice is magnified, which has been evident throughout McCarthy's 9 months as Speaker. A government shutdown of any duration would hurt Iowans. About 2,000 would stop getting paychecks. Work projects and federal lending would stop. The Biden administration says money for the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program will be in a vulnerable state even with status quo funding, let alone the bottom falling out. Those facts should be reason enough for Representatives Randy Feenstra, Ashley Hinson, Marionette Miller-Meeks, and Zach Nunn to publicly announce that they won't support major changes in any temporary bill because doing so risks a shutdown. Such a commitment from four Iowans plus one more representative would make clear that the status quo is the only viable path. Republicans' repeated attempts to use the doomsday brinkmanship, debt limit, fiscal cliff, and so on, to achieve what they cannot muster support for in normal legislation, is odious. But even if the Iowa quartet disagrees with that, they ought to find compelling the views of Iowa's senior senator, Republican Chuck Grassley, on government shutdowns. He said recently on Iowa PBS's Iowa Press that shutdowns are counterproductive, noting that the demands that forced past shutdowns were rarely satisfied in the end, meaning all that's accomplished is weakening safety nets, forcing federal workers to visit food banks, and tanking public confidence in our leaders. He also endorsed a call this month from Senator James Lankford, a Republican from Oklahoma, to pass bipartisan legislation that would require Congress to work nonstop without taxpayer-funded travel to resolve budget impasses like these, while automatic continuing resolutions keep the federal government running. Quote, "If you don't get it done, Congress works 7 days a week until we get this thing settled," Grassley said. Of course, this is not the direction things are heading. On Wednesday, with 8 business days left in the fiscal year, all of the Congress attention was on the House Judiciary Committee as it called in Attorney General Merrick Garland. Republicans on the committee sounded off with wild accusations and innuendo. The accusations about how Garland's Justice Department has dealt with its duty while prosecuting Donald Trump, the innuendo about vague and or unproven connections between Hunter Biden's troubles and his father, President Joe Biden. Another day lost. The legislation Grassley mentioned is worth considering, but with 10 shutdowns in the past 44 years, maybe an even more aggressive approach to get budgets approved by October 1st is in order. House and Senate rules could be amended to provide that missing the deadline by a certain number of days means both parties in each chamber must elect new leadership. And besides requiring Congress to work nonstop after October 1st until budgets are passed, let's also not pay members with no retroactive checks until that work is done. Why should they get paid when they haven't done their job? Clearly, we need something, anything, to provide motivation for this mandatory task. It's a well-worn saw for Iowa politicians to criticize the federal government for one thing or another, and then appeal to local pride by saying something like, "We don't have that problem here in Iowa." This might be the rare case where that proclamation is justified. The Iowa legislature typically hits its mark for passing appropriations bills with weeks to spare, even during divided government. When it tested that deadline in 2011, Iowa's balanced budget was still passed on June 30th, the last day of the state's fiscal year. State agencies were granted some grace to adapt to the new numbers, and legislators admitted they weren't happy with the experience. There is no upside if Congress allows the government to shut down for any length of time. Republican members, including Iowa's delegation, should loudly tell Speaker Kevin McCarthy to ditch the threats and do some real work. This is signed by Lucas Grandmeier on behalf of the Register's editorial board. Now here's one more from the New York Times. The internet is about to get much worse. Written by Julia Angwin. Greg Marston, a British voice actor, recently came across Connor online, an AI-generated clone of his voice trained on a recording of Mr. Marston he had made in 2003. It was his voice uttering things he had never said. Back then, he had recorded a session for IBM and later signed a release form allowing the recording to be used in many ways. Of course, at that time, Mr. Marston couldn't envision that IBM would use anything more than the exact utterances he had recorded. Thanks to artificial intelligence, however, IBM was able to sell Mr. Marston's decades-old sample to websites that are using it to build a synthetic voice that could say anything. Mr. Marston recently discovered his voice emanating from the Wimbledon website during the tennis tournament. IBM said it is aware of Mr. Marston's concern and is discussing it with him directly. His plight illustrates why many of our economy's best-known creators are up in arms. We are in a time of eroding trust as people realize that their contributions to a public space may be taken, monetized, and potentially used to compete with them. When that erosion is complete, I worry that our digital public spaces might become even more polluted with untrustworthy content. Already, artists are deleting their work from X, formerly known as Twitter, after the company said it would be using data from its platform to train its AI Hollywood writers and actors who are on strike, partly because they want to ensure their work is not fed into AI systems that companies could try to replace them with. News outlets, including the New York Times and CNN, have added files to their website to help prevent AI chatbots from scraping their content. Authors are suing AI outfits, alleging that their books are included in the site's training data. OpenAI has argued in a separate proceeding that the use of copyrighted data for training AI systems is legal under the fair use provisions of copyright law. While creators of quality content are contesting how their work is being used, dubious AI-generated content is stampeding into the public sphere. NewsGuard has identified 475 AI-generated news and information websites in 14 languages. 475. AI-generated music is flooding streaming websites and generating AI royalties for scammers. AI-generated books, including a mushroom foraging guide that could lead to mistakes in identifying highly poisonous fungi, are so prevalent on Amazon that the company is asking authors who self-publish on its Kindle platform to also declare if they're using AI. This is a classic case of tragedy of the commons, where a common resource is harmed by the profit interests of individuals. The traditional example of this is a public field that cattle can graze upon. Without any limits, individual cattle owners have an incentive to overgraze the land, destroying its value to everybody. We have commons on the internet, too. Despite all of its toxic corners, it is full of vibrant portions that serve the public good. Places like Wikipedia and Reddit forums, where volunteers often share knowledge in good faith and work hard to keep bad actors at bay. But these commons are now being overgrazed by rapacious tech companies that seek to feed all of the human wisdom, expertise, humor, anecdotes, and advice they find in these places into their for-profit AI systems. Consider, for instance, that the volunteers who build and maintain Wikipedia trusted that their work would be used according to the terms of their site, which requires attribution. Now, some Wikipedians are apparently debating whether they have any legal recourse against chatbots that use their content without citing the source. Regulators are trying to figure it out, too. The European Union is considering the first set of global restrictions on AI, which would require some transparency from generative AI systems, including providing summaries of copyrighted data that was used to train its systems. That would be a good step forward, since many AI systems do not fully disclose the data they were trained on. It has primarily been journalists who have dug up the murky data that lies beneath the glossy surface of the chatbots. In recent investigation, detailed in The Atlantic, revealed that more than 170,000 pirated books are included in the training data for Meta's AI chatbot, Llama. A Washington Post investigation revealed that OpenAI's ChatGPT relies on data scraped without consent from hundreds of thousands of websites. But transparency is hardly enough to rebalance the power between those whose data is being exploited and the companies poised to cash in on the exploitation. Tim Friendlander, founder and president of the National Association of Voice Actors, has called for AI companies to adopt ethical standards. He says that actors need three C's: consent, control, and compensation. In fact, all of us need the three C's. Whether we are professional actors or we just post pictures on social media, everyone should have the right to meaningful consent on whether we want our online lives fed into the giant AI machines. And consent would not mean having to locate a bunch of hard-to-find opt-out buttons to click, which is where the industry is heading. Compensation is harder to figure out, especially since most of the AI bots are primarily free services at the moment. But make no mistake, the AI industry is planning to and will make money from these systems, and when it does, there will be a reckoning with those whose works fueled the profits. For people like Mr. Marston, their livelihoods are at stake. He estimates that his AI clone has already lost him jobs and will cut into his future earnings significantly. He is working with a lawyer to seek compensation. quote, "I never agreed or consented to having my voice cloned, to see, hear it released to the public, thus competing against myself," he told me. But even if those of us who don't have a job directly threatened by AI think of writing that novel or composing a song or recording a TikTok or making a joke on social media, if we don't have any protections from the AI data overgrazers, I worry that it will feel pointless to even try to create in public, and that would be a real tragedy. Now in the Metro Briefs column, Happy Man to Perform Monday, Cedar Falls. Cathal Dunn, Ireland's Happy Man, will perform at 7 p.m. Monday at the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center on the University of Northern Iowa campus. The performance is presented by the Metro Community Concert Series. Dunn is a native of County Cork, Ireland, and is known as a pianist, composer, comedian, storyteller, author, and TV personality. His recording of Happy Man was a number one hit in Europe and Ireland. The concert series is $70 and includes four more shows throughout the season. Season tickets are required to attend, and they're available at the Gallagher Blue Dorn PAC ticket office or by calling area code 319-273-4849. More information is available by calling area code 319-939-2753. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.